Ladies and gentlemen, when I received my first briefing for this talk, I was told that the topic was ufology in the future. Well, I find that rather difficult to envisage. But I think the best thing we can do, first of all, is to take a long and searching look, and a calm one, at past and present ufology. Start off by telling you a case which I feel very few of you, if any, know. It was just about 6 o'clock on an evening when the sun was setting and the people were leaving the offices in this city, all pouring out onto the main streets, a very busy and crowded place, and a group of officials and airmen, air crew of Air France were standing out on the pavement outside the office. Suddenly, someone pointed out a light, a very bright green light, which at first was thought to be a star. And they looked, it was rather too bright for a star. And this light, to their horror, they saw, was coming straight down towards the city, towards the southeastern corner of the city, where on a horseshoe ring of hills, which swept round the southern part of this city, was stationed a palace. It was the old Queen's Palace. And in a few seconds, they suddenly thought, well, my goodness, this is going to hit this building. But to their infinite relief, at the last few split seconds, it swept aside and disappeared behind the Horseshoe Hill. A few seconds later, there it was again, appearing, zooming up on the far side of the Horseshoe Hill, over another palatial building, the Government Palace. And again, there was a near miss. And it arose high into the air, swept down, straight towards the centre of the city. Now, by this time, several hundreds, maybe thousands of people were on the pavement, aghast, gaping at this sight. And as this thing headed down towards the old marketplace, it again straightened out its passage and came straight across the city, parallel to the main thoroughfare, which is known as the Rue de la Libération. And as it went by, the Air France officers, we're indebted to the head of the Air France office for this story, saw that the green light was a lenticular-shaped, glowing thing. And it was estimated that it was about 40 meters in front of yet another object, a long cylindrical shape, and that again this cylindrical shape was about the length of the body of a Constellation airliner. And again behind this cylindrical shape, at again a distance of about 40 meters, there was a long trail of light, some say sparks, something like this. And this queer object, or series of objects, hurtled along the length of the Rue de la Libération, out towards the station at the northern part of the city, where it was last seen swinging round to the left by the people in front of the Air France office. Later they heard that it did an abrupt turn towards the southeast, over the zoo, where animals went into a terrible state of uproar, and then off into the open country. Well, there's a vast amount of speculation as to what this thing, which was first thought to be a meteorite, was, as you can well imagine. And the Air France officer and his colleagues were in touch with other friends of theirs in a road which, at about a distance of a couple of hundred metres, runs parallel with the main thoroughfare, the Rue de la Libération. And they had been looking to the east when they saw this strange apparition, whereas the Air France officers had been looking towards the west. So you see that this thing, at an estimated altitude of about 200 metres, was less than 100 metres from the original observers when it went past them. Well, this attracted an awful lot of attention because as it approached the marketplace and began to go over the main part of the city, all the lights went out. And it is estimated that somewhere in the neighbourhood of 20,000 people saw the passage of this object. It couldn't have come at a busier time of the day. There is a priest astronomer in this city, Father Cove, who interviewed personally more than 5,000 witnesses and took their accounts. This is a mammoth task. And yet, I suspect that in this hall here, people who are very interested in this subject, who have devoted a part of their time to reading about it and studying it, there's only a bare handful of people who know about this case. And I suspect that those people who know about the case only know because I told them. There's another talk somewhere or the other. Now, why is this so? This has never been revealed to the outside big bad world, and it happened many years ago. Well, I think it's a very long story, and it covers the whole of this UFO business. The modern story, the modern epic, some say it began with the Foo Fighters during the war. Others prefer to say, well, possibly with the ghost rocket scare over Sweden, which was a very real and very large flap, I believe. But the publicity for this subject started, as we all know, in 1947. In June, to be precise. We've had this rammed home very well and truly this year. There was an interesting case, actually, in June. I think it was the 21st of June, 47, which some of you may have read about recently in very short form in the review, over Maury Island, when a number of discs in the shape of a circle were witnessed by some people in a fishing boat, with one in the centre of this ring, which appeared to be in some kind of diptery. It was undulating, sweeping up and down in its flight. There were, supposed, the witnesses alleged that they saw smoke, and finally, as it was right overhead, something dropped out of it and killed the dog in the boat. Well, the Americans have had attached to the Air Force a project which for many years has now been known as Project Blue Book. And the first officer in charge of this project was a Captain Ruppelt. And he described this Maury Island thing as a sadistic hoax, presumably because the dog was killed. And yet this case came before there was any startling, sensational publicity for the story, the flying saucer story. In fact, the publicity started 3 days later, on 24th of June 1947. I won't go into that particular case. We've heard enough about it recently, and various people have followed it up in their own certain fashion. But we do know that the witness there, the prime witness, K. Kenneth Arnold described the things he saw, or at least their motion, as being like saucers skipping over water, or being skipped over water. Well, when you think of it, this is a ludicrous description, but he merely used it to give some idea of what it looked like to him. Unfortunately, an enterprising journalist who wanted a nice, quick story heard this description, and for better or worse, we're numbered with the name Flying Saucers. When you think about it, really, the name is almost as silly as calling these things, without any proof whatsoever, spaceships. There's not a shred of evidence anywhere that I can see, except perhaps in the most way-out, controversial contactee claims, that these things are indeed extraterrestrial spaceships. Many people like to think they are. We cannot discard this theory, but please remember, there's no evidence of this. Anyway, spaceships were quickly in vogue as a result of this claim by Kenneth Arnold. Long before we began to hear of the contactees, this thing happened. The interpretation has stuck with us ever since. Now then, this silliness, this flying saucer silliness, led immediately to a lot of hoaxes. There were many publicity seekers on the scene, and it was even used for commercial advertising in the most lurid fashion. I've seen many of these adverts. In fact, as a result of all this, this brand new little subject, this brand new little topic, very interesting, especially after the ghost rockets, if you remember them, became a musical joke. And this was a tragedy. As there is no solid, captive evidence of any of these alleged craft or objects, we have to rely on data for scientific study. If we're attempting to do a scientific study of this thing, we want lots and lots of data so that it can be assessed. And nowadays, in the machine age that's upon us, it can be put into these computers. Well, vast quantities of data have been missed, precisely because of this musical atmosphere which surrounded the thing. Scientists, and who can blame them, immediately became very shy. There was no official or no university-backed study as a result, and many years were wasted. It was left to just a few, I might say, very brave amateurs, or foolhardy, you can look at it that way, to collect what data they could. And meanwhile, the hoaxers and the lunatic fringe collected the publicity. The scientists were frightened even farther away. Now, in those early days, news media climbed in quickly for a sensational story and quickly burned their fingers. And the result of this was that there was a frivolous attitude thereafter in the press. But despite all this, the reports persisted. They kept coming in. And they kept coming in from people in all professions, in all walks of life, from doctors and from scientists, from farm labourers, and from airmen. There were many reports from airmen in the early days. There's a reason why there were many reports then, which we hear nothing about now. In all, the quality of the witnesses was pretty good. Well, in 1952, we've had a lot of cases in 47 and 48, and odd ones here and there after that, but in 1952, things reached a very great peak. And there were many cases where radar confirmed the presence of strange things. The result of all this was that there's a very serious strain on the intelligence wire services in the United States. Now, at the moment, I'm concentrating on the United States, very obvious reason, as you will see, because the United States are the big ones, they're the big power, and other people follow in their wake. Now, the near intelligence wire services were seriously bombed by a great clutter of UFO reports in 1952 and early 1953, and something had to be done about it. The reason why something had to be done about it, for those whose memories don't go back that far, was that there was a very bitter and nasty war being fought at the time in Korea. So something had to be done. And it was done in January 1953. The United States Air Force set up a small committee of four members under a man named Robertson, who's now passed on. They studied, I think it was 20 cases, 20 or 24 cases only, and they spent 4 days on this study. And at the end of these 4 days, they pontificated. They stated that no danger was posed by these objects that were being reported, no danger to the security of the United States. They also asserted that they were not artifacts of a hostile foreign power. And they added a third recommendation that the public should be educated in the observation of natural phenomena. In 1953, there weren't satellites in those days. Well, the CIA was behind the setting up of this committee, the Central Intelligence Agency. And when they saw the report, they decided that it wasn't good enough. And they wrote in a fourth recommendation. And this was a secret clause. It went only to the Air Force commanders and other military people. And this clause was, in as many words, that on every opportunity, flying saucer and flying saucer reports were to be debunked. There's a very good reason, as I told you. They wanted to get the intelligence wires clear of this enormous clutter of reports. There were something like 1,500, I believe, in the United States during 1952 alone. And when you're trying to get on with the war, it's rather difficult to absorb all this stuff as well. They wanted to get these tiresome things shut under the carpet. The press were heartily discouraged, and the clamps went on. Now, for many years, we always thought, when we were discussing this in private, the previous editor of the Review and myself, that the clamps went on in 54. Well, we've now discovered, of course, that they went on a year before. Blue Book, the Project Blue Book, always continued cheerfully to debunk these things at every opportunity. They left just a little residue, I suppose, where even they couldn't afford to blush too much, of about 2.5% cases which they insisted were unidentified. When I spoke to Dr. Hynek a year or two ago, he told me how horrified he was. Now, he was the United States Air Force civilian scientific consultant on this subject. And he told us that it took him eight years before he realized that there was a persistent phenomenon which needed close study. And then he used to go to this Blue Book office occasionally, and he was horrified to see how these officials, one officer, a couple of sergeants, a couple of secretaries, I believe, investigated these cases. 99 times out of 100, they never even left their office. They just read the report that they'd got and reached for a stamp and plonked it on. It was as simple as that. The trouble with this business, of course, is that witnesses' reputations were not spared in all this debunking. And nobody told Project Blue Book to lay off. After the Korean War had finished, they continued to debunk. And in fact, they continued to do that right up to last year, maybe even the present day. Well, at about that time, Dr. Hynek had an article in the Journal of the American Society of Opticians, I believe it was, and one thing that he pointed out in this article was that ridicule is not part of the scientific method, and the public should not be taught that it is. Well, as you see, the result of this, with practically every other country in the world following the United States lead, it's hardly surprising that the case about which I told you at the opening of this talk was never published, that never reached the outside world. It was published in the local papers in Madagascar. You've all been waiting for me to tell you that, where it happened. And the city was Antananarivo, which is a very vast and thriving and very busy place. But it was never heard in metropolitan France or in any other part of the world. It happened in August, I think it was the second Monday in August of 1954, which was after the Robertson Report and after the debunking started. It was also after the case, which I won't trouble you with at the moment, the case of Captain James Howard and the VOAC Stratocruiser. But there was another case, which very few people know about, again, which followed the BOAC case, which occurred, I believe, on the 29th of June, 1954. It followed that about 17 hours after Captain Howard's sighting. On this occasion, three plane loads of journalists, photographers, cinema photographers, scientists, meteorologists, the lot, three plane loads of them, took off from an airfield in Norway to fly northwards to photograph and generally examine the eclipse of the sun, which was taking place on that afternoon. Suddenly, someone shouted out that out there in the sun, they were flying in the shadow, there were two rather weird-looking objects at some distance away, proceeding in what appeared to be a falling, tumbling flight, somewhere up near the polar regions. And they all looked at this, these phenomena, and scratched their heads. They didn't know what on earth this was. And then suddenly it began to dawn on them that this was something, perhaps, which they had never thought was true, which they thought were fairy stories. And a general hubbub ensued. In fact, it was only in the last few minutes or so that someone remembered that they got a whole host of photographic equipment on the plane, and someone managed to get a camera up and started rolling. And the epic film still exists somewhere. It was shown in this country in, I think, late 1954. It did form part of a Pathé newsreel, but they... A big pun? I'm sorry, I'm not sure on that point. You would tell me later, I'm very interested. We've been trying to discover where it went. It formed part of a newsreel. And was shown in London by a Swedish trade delegation as a sort of press conference. Now then, immediately, some very sceptical gentlemen started making rude remarks about it. And you've heard the quality of the people who saw this thing and who photographed it. This was stated without having remembered what they were told about the expedition and about the aircraft, that these gentlemen had been watching and photographing reflections on the windows of the aircraft. They completely ignored what they'd been told about the aircraft, and that the windows had been taken out to avoid such reflections. But when they were destroyed on that one, then someone said, well, these must have been seagulls. Well, I don't know how big seagulls are in those parts of the world, I suspect they must be enormous if this is so, because it was estimated that the objects were at a distance. They had the shadow of the eclipse, and then the light beyond to estimate this, by which to estimate this. It was estimated that they were 17 miles distant, and possibly at about 18,000 feet. That one was shot down, but even so, they were unrepentant about this. And the third suggestion that was made about this particular thing was that they had been watching a Russian secret weapon. It seemed that the gentlemen of the press, so taken up with this business of debunking, so into the swing of it, preferred that Russians had secret weapons flying willy-nilly in polar regions being witnessed by us to something of a more unconventional nature. It was preferable to have something like that rather than admit that it was possibly an unidentified flying object. Well, I can give you now a few examples. Blue Book beauties, I've labelled them here on my notes. I'm indebted. I know NICAP, National Investigation Commission of Aerial Phenomena, have recorded some of these cases, but I'm indebted to Dr. James MacDonald, who sent me a beautiful summary of all these things and a lovely address which he gave to the Society of American Newspaper Editors in April. I've chosen one or two of these cases because you may recognize some similarities with things which have been happening recently. And the first one started in Portage County, a place called Ravenna in Ohio. There were two police officers on patrol around, I believe it was an armory or an armament work or a TNT park, something which was highly explosive anyway, at 500 hours, 0500, and Neff, they were both deputies. Suddenly, when they were investigating a car which had been abandoned at the side of the road, they observed a luminous object which was coming down the side of a hill over the trees, the woods, towards them. And it was so bright that it lightened up the pre-dawn light. They immediately sent a radio call that this thing had appeared on the scene and had then hopped off along the road in front of them. The deputies were told by their dispatcher at the radio desk to follow the thing and to keep on its tail, because a camera car was being sent with great urgency to get a shot. Well, the police did just what they were told. For an hour and a half they pursued this thing, which went in fits and starts and always kept ahead of them, rather like a carrot being dangled in front of donkeys. And more police became involved in this pursuit. There was a man named Huston from Palestine, Ohio. And he heard all this kerfuffle going on the radio, so he thought he would go and investigate. And he took up station on a side road where it entered the main road along which this procession was later to follow. In fact, he saw the luminous object sweeping along above the road ahead of the other policemen who were approaching something like 100 miles an hour. So he swung in behind and joined the chase. And then they reached a place called Conway, some 70 miles after they'd started, which is just north of Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania, right out of one state into another, and found another officer watching this approaching circus with great amazement. In fact, they were then saw this object which they had described as approximately 40 feet in diameter, very luminous, with a fin, what appeared to be a fin, on the upper rear portion of it, and a cone of diffuse light below. They saw this thing just shoot off straight up into the sky and disappear. Well, the Blue Book decided they would have to investigate this. And the investigation was conducted over long-distance telephone. I think it lasted 4 minutes. And during this time, Major Quintanilla spoke to Deputy Spohr and told him, point blank, that he'd been watching the passage of the satellite Echo. I don't know which one, one or two, but he was watching Echo. And that he had, during the course half of the chase, transferred his visual faculties to the appearance of you-know-who, Venus. Well, the press were rather agitated by this because the police wouldn't have any of this. So it was suggested that an on-the-spot, face-to-face investigation was carried out. And again, Major Quintilian turned up, and I believe some NICAP people turned up as well with a recorder, and they have it on the record that Quintilian tried to bully both the police constables that they had been watching Echo and Venus. And this explanation that these policemen had chased, these very reliable observers, had chased Venus and were joined by two others, and Echo for 90 miles, 70 miles, but 90 miles an hour or more through two states, stands on the record as an observation of Echo and Venus. And that is one of the 97.5% which Blue Book have always insisted are explained. We go back a few years to another Blue Book case, to the 4th of July, 1961. When a very experienced pilot, a man named Ernest Stadebeck, who was the owner of a local air taxi service, was flying his own plane when he saw and reported two objects in the sky. He reported it to the Air Force, not to the press. He went to see Blue Book at Dayton, Ohio, and came out when Blue Book announced to the public, now Stadbeck hadn't announced this himself, announced to the public that this experienced airman had misinterpreted a very malign star, Capella. And he said, well, Capella appeared twice. The first time it dived at me from a great height and went off in one direction, and while I was watching it, it appeared again under the aircraft. It flew off in the other direction. But that is another one of the 97.5% explained cases. And Stadbeck, of course, had been made look a complete idiot in public, and he was very annoyed about this. He refused thereafter to discuss the thing. But he did say that over the radio telephone, Cleveland Air authorities confirmed that they had a radar fix on the second of the objects, and it also had a visual sighting of it. A couple of days later, they denied this to the press. Now, the third case is one which appeals to me very much indeed. We go back yet another year to 1960, to the 13th of August. Again, police were involved. We'll have opposition. Two police officers named Carson and Scott. And they were patrolling a back road south of Red Bluff in California. And at 11 o'clock in the evening, they saw an object which they thought was an aircraft about to crash. They tried to radio through for assistance, for ambulances, but couldn't get through because their radio seemed to be blotted out by a lot of static. And as this thing came nearer, they jumped out of their car in some alarm and prepared to give assistance. And then the thing seemed to stop and go upwards. And at this stage, they saw that it was cylindrical in shape. And it appeared to have a light at each end, rather like a searchlight sweeping around. And at one time, it was only approached to within 100 feet of them. And they were so alarmed that they drew their pistols. Well, then it went up higher, out of the way, the static appeared to cease, they got a call through to one of their dispatchers, they asked for assistance, and approaching constables in another car, radioed into the spot immediately, didn't see this object, but they saw a glow, to confirm, in an absolutely dark countryside, over the place where these police were. Now then, one of the messages that the constables got back to their dispatcher, was please find out if the Red Bluff Air Force Base had, in fact, got anything on their radar. And they got a call back on the phone that, indeed, the Red Bluff Air Force Base had such a call, had such a sighting on their radar. Well, this case got immediate publicity, and Blue Book came straight in on the scene. And this case got immediate publicity, and Blue Book came straight in on the scene. And the next morning after when they came back on duty, these two officers went to the Air Force base and wanted to interview the radar operators. They were not permitted on the base. They were not allowed to speak to them, and it was publicly denied that any radar fix had indeed been obtained. And Blue Book, I forget who the officer in charge was at the time, announced 4 days after the sighting that these very experienced policemen had been greatly alarmed by a refraction of light through inversion layers of the planet Mars, of the stars Aldebaran and Betelgeuse. Well, someone smelt a rat, someone who knew something about this smelt a rat, and asked an astronomer, please, would he confirm that indeed these stars were visible? And the astronomer said, no, not one of them is visible, not one of them is in the Californian skies at this time. And Blue Book heard that. And they then said, sorry, these officers were looking at refractions of light of Mars, they insisted on Mars, and Capella. Well, where have we got to? Yes. Capella was indeed in the sky at the time, but it was in a completely different quarter from the direction in which the officers had been witnessing this strange thing. In fact, Police Officer Carson said he'd sure hate to take one of his cases to the court with such flimsy evidence, with such a weak argument. And it's noteworthy that our dear old friend Dr. Menzel joined in this particular argument. He agreed with Blue Book. He said it was a fantastic night of multiple inversions and of humidity. And that stood on the record for some 6 years. Until Dr. James MacDonald, to whom I'm indebted for reading these cases, said that he had studied radio sonde data for the day, and there were no such conditions whatsoever reported. Now, Dr. James MacDonald is professor of meteorology at Tucson, at University of Arizona in Tucson, and he is head of the Department of Atmospheric Physics. I think we should take what he says as having a grain of truth in it. He has access to a vast amount of meteorological and other data. Well, as I said before, this was a tragedy. Now, you've seen how Blue Book went about their debunking. Other countries have followed this sheepishly. And the whole thing became so ludicrous, particularly in the States, that in 1966 there was a press and a public outcry. And I don't have to harp on the Michigan case, which was really quite insignificant, but yet had quite a deal of significance attached to it. But Dr. Hynek there let slip a remark which was heard by press reporters at a press conference about the Michigan cases. He wondered, and he had every right to wonder, whether indeed the witnesses had been watching the spontaneous combustion of marsh gas. Well, this brought the house down, apparently, and it led to the hearing in Washington as a result, when Hynek was himself present, sat at the table with the other representatives of the House of Representatives and actually addressed them at the invitation of the chairman. The outcome of this talk of Hynek's was the setting up of the Colorado University Committee with Air Force funds, first of all to the tune of $300,000 and later an extension of time and a further $200,000. The committee set up consists of two physicists, I'm told, and the rest of the body are psychiatrists. Well, this has been greeted as a big white hope by people all over the world. In the January-February edition of the Review, I expressed a measure of doubt, which I hope most of you saw. If you didn't, I'll read it to you now. Speaking about the Colorado University Committee. On the surface, this is all very encouraging. Nevertheless, there's one small worry that needs to be recorded. Has the United States Air Force, on finding itself forced into a corner by public pressure and by ridicule of two facile explanations of UFO reports, undertaken the investigation merely to re-establish its image and to play for time by sidestepping an awkward situation? We like to think that this is not the case, but the worry lingers at the back of our minds, thanks to past dealings with officialdom. We felt that the best we could hope for from the Condon Committee was that they would examine material from all over the world. After all, they had a lot of money. They could get material from all over the world. They are backed by the Library of Congress, who are finding everything they can, digesting it and sending it to them. We hoped for at least a statement in their report that there would be a very real case to examine. No one in their right senses would expect them to solve the mystery. It would have been a stroke of great fortune if they could have done, but we didn't expect this. But now, I'm afraid, for the last few months, in fact, I've been hearing very disturbing rumours from Colorado, or about the Colorado people. People have been telling me things, these people I trust implicitly, names that are very well known to you, that even some have suggested that the whole thing is a fake-up. Indeed, something indeed to gain time until they could get this awful problem off their backs and then sink it for good and all. Well, I do not know the truth of this. I do know that my friends in France are very gloomy about it and are expecting the worst. And an authoritative American told me recently that Dr. Condon is indeed stumped. Well, we thought he would be. We know that. He's even stated that he's worried because he doesn't have his investigators on the spot when cases occurred. Well, I mean, we never expected him to. No one knows where these things are going to turn up. It's like watching for Christmas, going out looking for them. He wants new ideas. There's even been a suggestion that he would like to hear some ideas from us. Well, all he needs to do in that case is to read the Flying Saucer Review. He's had every copy sent to him that's available. I do know one thing, that one of his committee members showed an alarming ignorance of the whole problem. That very parochial way on about 70 United States cases only. And that when other people, in fact somebody from France, spoke to this same member of the committee, he was horrified to hear him say that he thought the Socorro landing case was unique, that he'd never heard of anything happening in America. Well, I don't know what game they're playing, whether this is true or what, but we certainly can't get a true evaluation of the problem if they just base it on Socorro and one or two American cases. So frankly, I'm a little bit worried about the Condon business. It seems that we'll be indeed very lucky to get a statement that this subject deserves detailed, long-term investigation. And in the end, as I've already suggested in the latest issue of the Review, if we have to stand alone, we'll have to stand alone and fight ourselves. Well, that is how we see one aspect of the future. Everybody looks for Colorado to produce something, and I rather fear, I don't say for sure, I may stand absolutely condemned by this, but I fear that it's going to be a damp squib. Well, I believe you want me to say something about recent cases. And quite frankly, I'm a little bit of a disadvantage here, because we haven't really had time to study those little flap of ours in this country. I've seen the reports like you have, and we'd had one or two friends of ours investigate a case or two. But when I was telling you about the Ravenna police chase, you probably remembered a similar incident which, although it didn't cover such a vast amount of ground, went on for quite a few miles in this country recently, at Oakhampton, or near Oakhampton. Now this was suggested that these police were chasing our dear old friend Venus. Now a very reliable colleague of mine has interviewed these two police officers in some detail, and he tells me that they are convinced and that he feels that he must endorse their conviction that they were not following Venus. We've also heard about cross-shaped things which have been appearing in the sky, formations. The Ministry of Defence did not claim to know anything about any cross-shaped formation. 2 days later, a clergyman, who I believe has been involved in affairs at Warminster, said, yes, he knows what this is. This is an American flight refueling operation. And attached with this, the Ministry of Defence there said, yes, I suppose it must be. Until, shortly afterwards, the Americans announced that, yes, they had had flight refueling operations that day. Over Scotland, not Sussex. So the other day, a very interesting case was telephoned into me, details of this case were telephoned into me by one of my readers who lives in Winchester. Now this gentleman's hired car, I didn't know at the time, he sounded an entirely reliable person. The case was far too hot for me to handle, so I passed it over to my friend Ronald Bedford, who is the science editor of The Sun, and let him have a go, because this needed an immediate go at the Minister of Defence. This chap in Winchester is a lecturer in electronics at Southampton University, so I've discovered since. And he was sitting at the table about just after 2 o'clock. They'd just finished lunch, he and his family, including his son, aged 13, when they were practically blasted out of their seats by a tremendous roar of jet aircraft. Now, the son is a very enthusiastic aero modeler, and he rushed immediately to the window, or out through the window, the French window, and saw quickly two Royal Air Force Lightning aircraft flying quite low, possibly, I don't know exactly how low, but possibly the order of 1,000 feet, with their reheat on, over an inhabited city, this is. And they were chasing what the boy described, he described it to me over the telephone, as an opaque, black-looking, mushroom-shaped object, which was leaving these two lightnings, which must have been going somewhere in the order of 1,300 miles an hour, was leaving them slowly behind. In fact, the object did a half-right turn without appearing to bank, and then, again, without appearing to change aspect at all, to go vertically upwards, practically, into the clouds, with the lightning struggling behind it. Well, the Minister of Defence has replied to that, that they own no lightnings in that area. Well, the hint, too, from them was that there are no lightning stations around there. But we've discovered since that there are two stations. Most of the lightnings are, indeed, in the eastern part of the country. But there are two stations where there are lightnings, and they are within a few minutes flying time of Winchester. One of them is Boscombe Down, of course. Now, the mention of Boscombe Down reminds me that the subject is, I think, growing more and more respectable. I was very surprised and gratified a few months ago to receive an invitation from the Royal Aeronautical Society branch at Boscombe Down, the Royal Air Force Weapons and Aircraft Experimental Station, to lecture them on flying saucers, and that's what they call them. It was an extremely
interesting lecture when it took place on the 10th of October, and they expected some 50 people to turn up for this first meeting of the season. I tactfully suggested to the squadron leader who arranged it that it'd probably need a few more than 50 chairs. And at tea, before the talk, he told me, well, yes, I put up 80. Well, when I walked over with the station superintendent and the weapons group captain and a couple of others to the lecture hall, the squadron leader came running out and said, please, gentlemen, don't go in yet. There's a bit of reorganisation going on. We've got 130 or 140 turned up. So that is something at a place like that. I wish, quite frankly, that this Winchester affair had occurred before my talk at Boscombe Downs. We might have discovered something. One of the questions which was asked me at Boscombe Downs by one of the guests, a clergyman again, was, in all your talk, which I found pretty interesting, you have not made one mention to all the incredible things which are going on not so very far away from here at Warminster. Now, I had to tell him, as I also told a very lively and interested audience at the Imperial College of Science, London, recently. I see some of my friends smiling, they were present. But indeed, some very strange things have been going on at Warminster. So strange that, quite frankly, we don't know what is going on, really. Lots of people are endangering themselves, putting themselves in very severe danger of catching pneumonia, standing on top of windy hills. As I said before, waiting for Christmas. There was a very interesting phenomenon. We told Dr. Hynek about this when we met him. In the early days at Warminster, when a noise was heard in many places, and Hynek immediately said, poltergeist phenomena. And indeed, it does sound like it. And following that, a rather remarkable prophecy was made in the local newspaper by a man named Holton, that following little examinations he'd made of noise situations, points where noises had occurred, that he forecast in some strange way by drawing straight lines and intersecting them, I don't know, I can't put any validity to this, but he said that there would be a very strange, he prophesied there'd be a very strange, luminous apparition over or near Warminster. Now, this appeared in the Warminster Journal, and I believe the date of its appearance was the 4th of June, 1965. On the night before, the evening of the 3rd of June, 1965, the clergyman are getting very much in on this business, the clergyman and his family, three sons, one of whom had a portable telescope, indeed witnessed a very strange aerial phenomenon hanging over Haytesbury to the south of Warminster. And this thing was also reported by 20 or 30 people in other parts of the district. The thing was in sight. It was cylindrical, glowing, standing up on end, hovering over the place at a considerable height for something like half an hour before it suddenly took off upwards, and became just a light source and then disappeared. Now, then there have been, I believe, one or two other surprising reports from Warminster, but otherwise it does rather occur to me that everybody's being taken in by people who are watching satellites or lightning and other things and trying to keep the pot boiling all the time for local interest. I haven't much faith in many of the things that come from Warminster. Well, what can we do in the future? Well, the first thing is to keep calm all the time. I suggest that a lot of interest and maybe some possible solutions can be discovered through studying landing cases. I haven't actually landing cases this afternoon, but they are our particular interest. We're beginning to discover similarities in creatures reported in many parts of the world. And I suggest, too, that people follow the Flying Saucer Review for what I trust is a serious and sober presentation of this business. if we must go, I'm only repeating something I said 2 or 3 issues ago. If we must go out from Windy Hills, then wrap up well and do it discreetly. Don't tell the press before you go, because, my goodness, they'll make charges, obviously, do. You must take the utmost care with them. They're not very careful when they report what you say to them. Another suggestion is that it might be a good idea to set up detector networks. These magnetic flux detectors do sometimes go off. There's a possibility that someone with a loaded camera nearby might be able to spot something and take a photograph. But again, discretion is needed. Let's keep it to ourselves, study the things, and then when we've got something which we think is good or solid, then we can announce it. We should also take very great care with reports, particularly good reports that we hear in the press. My friend Peter Hathelthwaite sets a very good example here, with some very careful investigations of cases. We shouldn't put leading questions to witnesses, shouldn't put the ideas in their heads. We must be very careful with them. It's the only way to dig out the details, especially when you think possibly an explanation by an official body like the Ministry of Defence may be phony. It does work. We've done it ourselves recently. We got them to retract over the air refueling thing. And also, someone sticking to their guns got the Royal Observatory at Hurst and so to say, in fact, that Venus hadn't been seen by certain people, that there was something under cloud level which wasn't Venus. Indeed, if it had been under cloud level, I would like to suggest the Russians have been sadly misinformed and wasting a lot of money recently. So, above all, please, try to keep off the hilltops. When you're up there, you're very easy targets on the skyline. Do remember that. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.